I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with a Deal. And today our guest is Keith Townsend, an M&A partner and the co-head of the corporate group at King & Spalding. Keith, thank you so much for joining us today.
David, great to be here. Appreciate you having me.
So we're going to talk about your background on today's podcast, how you went about building business development skills as a young partner, how you think about your role as a law firm manager, and finally, some of the key issues that you see facing King & Spalding and peer firms. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to the practice of law.
Sure, David. So I've been at King & Spalding now for about 25 years. I'm originally from Tennessee, grew up the first part of my childhood in a small town in West Tennessee, where my dad's father, my grandfather, had 8 siblings. He was the only sibling to leave that town. And I grew up seeing my dad as a practicing lawyer in that small town. And so the practice of law was always very familiar to me. Obviously, what my dad did, being kind of a jack of all trades lawyer at that stage, and what I do now are very different things, but at least the practice of law was familiar. And when I was in my middle school years, my mom and dad moved up to the big city of Knoxville, and my dad became what at the time I thought was a big firm lawyer, in a firm of about 25 lawyers in Knoxville, where he specialized in labor and employment law. And so that influence and seeing him as a lawyer was important to me as I began evaluating my career choices.
Obviously, your practice is really different from the ones your father had, but is there anything you took from his professional experience? Obviously, all lawyers have clients that you have used in your own career.
I think what I saw with him was it was evident that he was a trusted advisor. And that appealed to me as someone who was trusted to give both legal and personal advice, and that was something that was valued by his clients. And that was evident to me even as a young person, just seeing him, whether it was at home after work and he got a phone call and he was interacting with the people that he worked with. And that's important to me even today. I developed very close relationships with my clients, and I like to think that I am a trusted advisor. And just as I thought about what I wanted to do, that appealed to me.
And so then you went to college at the University of Tennessee and law school at the University of Virginia.
Right.
Talk about those years and how you came to focus on corporate law.
Sure. So I was lucky when I was at the University of Tennessee to get involved in the student government apparatus. So while some people were playing football and doing those things, I was one of the student government nerds. That was great for me because I had a real opportunity to interact with the board of trustees, senior leadership at the university, the chancellor, the president, and others. And I saw really the business of what the university did. And that was my first taste of business and just being interested in that aspect. And so as I thought about the legal profession, that was the first time I thought, maybe I wouldn't grow up being what I thought all lawyers did, right? Which is go to court and litigate, but I might do something slightly different. When I got to law school as a first year, I was able to clerk at a firm in Atlanta that was broad-based. And I still today, when I'm talking to law students evaluating their legal career, really say, look, if you have an opportunity to go to a big firm and just do a little bit of everything your first summer or your second summer, and that helps you figure out what you want to do, it's invaluable. Because I still came into that summer a little bit unsure, but I got to work on actual deals. I still remember when I was in that first year summer, going with one of the partners, we traveled up to DC and we did a deal where we pulled an all-nighter at Latham & Watkins offices in DC to close on a merger. And I thought that was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And that was really when I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to be a corporate lawyer. I want to be an M&A lawyer. And when I went back to law school after my first year, I really geared my coursework toward that. And then when I was thinking about jobs as a second year, I really focused on firms that I thought had a strong corporate practice.
And what did you really enjoy about that experience as your 1L summer? Was it the negotiation? Was it the adrenaline? Was it interacting with the various people? At that point, you actually physically would have been in a room, which doesn't happen all that often anymore.
I wish it did. Yeah, David, for me, it was a couple of things. One, I got a real charge out of just the ebb and flow. And there was the back and forth. But even in the deal context, of course, you're on different sides of the table, but ultimately you're working towards a common objective. That same summer, I also was involved in litigation, and I saw a couple of things with the litigation practice. One, it was very contentious. And two, it went on forever. And with the deals, I loved the fact that I started something that summer and we finished it that summer. And the ability to accomplish something, and frankly, at the end of it, usually you have clients that are pretty happy that the deal got done, you know, one way or the other. Not always, but a lot of times. And I saw that even as a summer associate and thought, you know, this is terrific. This is something I think I could enjoy as a career. And luckily, it's, you know, 25 years later, I think I made the right choice.
So you went to King & Spalding as a first-year associate after graduating from law school in 1999. Talk about those associate years and what your practice was like and how it shifted to M&A.
That's a great question. So I really started at King & Spalding in part because of who I interviewed with, connectivity to UVA in a group that was primarily focused on capital markets and securities law. So that was everything from working with companies on IPOs to investment grade and high yield debt offerings to even day-to-day securities, corporate governance, securities counseling type work. And I had really three mentors at the firm that helped me in those younger years. What I saw as I began to progress, and this is probably my third or fourth year at the firm, was that some of those clients that were company side clients were doing deals. They were selling themselves, for example, and take private transactions, and the firm was working on those matters. And so I had opportunities as a young associate to work on a number of those. I had some direct conversations with my mentors and said, look, it seems like if I progress and I become a partner, that's going to increasingly happen. And they agreed with me. And one of those partners in particular was about 90% public company M&A. That's really what he did. And he took me under his wing and helped me hone that M&A skill set, which was invaluable, right? And so at that point, my practice began to shift. And that's been hugely important so that when I'm working with a client and those sell side opportunities come up, I can easily pivot to handle those transactions. But that was a deliberate shift. I think my practice would be very different today if I hadn't made that conscious decision as a young associate.
And of course, in the early 2000s, you were starting to see real consolidation, effectively the disappearance of regional investment banks and consolidation among the largest investment banks as the amount of equity capital markets work diminished because there are just a lot fewer public companies.
And look, we were acutely impacted by that, and it influenced our strategy as a firm and within our corporate practice at that point in time, because we were the dominant player in the capital markets business in the Southeast, representing many of those regionals and super regionals. You're right, particularly following the dot-com crash, the world shifted and that work dissipated. And we went from a practice where we were probably 50% representing the banks and capital markets transactions and 50% the issuers to almost overnight, that being more like 80-20. And so the practice really needed to shift and change, and the firm used the halo effect of its brand in the Southeast in particular at that point in time to more deeply penetrate existing public company clients and to find new ones. And look, that's still somewhat true today in terms of the investments and the places where the firm has continued to focus over the last couple of decades.
So as a senior associate, a young partner, you had a practice that was increasingly focused on M&A, and you had mentors at the firm who were older, who had presumably relationships at companies in Atlanta and the Southeast. And then two of those mentors retire and one goes to a client. So what was the effect on you, presumably at a time in your career where you thought you had some runway to grow into being a partner?
Yeah, to be honest with you, David, it was a challenge for me on a personal level. I had really terrific mentors, and there's no way I would be where I am today without all three of them and others leaning in and investing in me. And you're right. They had terrific practices, terrific relationships. Two of them retired at a very, very young age, and one of them went off to become a general counsel. And it was probably at least 5 years earlier than in the ideal world I would have liked, because you go in and you're pitching a significant transaction. It's just a lot easier if you have some gray hair. Unfortunately, I have way too much of it now, but I had none of it back then. And there was a couple of year period where I frankly struggled. And I struggled, one, because they weren't there anymore, and I had relied on them heavily for client development, but also just mentorship on a personal level. But secondly, I grew up at a time in the firm where this isn't just King and Spalding, right? This is a lot of firms in that era. Business development wasn't in the day-to-day DNA. It was more the expectation, lawyers don't advertise, lawyers don't beg for work, the phone rings and you do the work.
Or you would grow into business development.
You would grow into it. But certainly it wasn't something that we actively trained our young lawyers at. I was fortunate to have more insight than I think the average lawyer into that, because I was so close to those mentors. I mean, I went to lunch with them weekly. One of those mentors, he was an extremely hard worker. And there was a group of us that had dinner together 3 or 4 nights a week at the firm on a break on work. And he was also in leadership at the firm. And so, I had some insight into that, but I was behind. The average young partner today is much more equipped than I think we were back then to understand and be effective at the business development aspect of what we do, and just understanding the business development apparatus of the firm. So it took me a while to grow into that, honestly.
And so how did you do that? What did you take courses? Did you study on your own? Did you talk to mentors and friends?
It was really all of the above. There were others at the firm that I sought advice on. What did they do? Some of it was watching, some of it was actively asking for their help. The one piece of advice I guess I would give to just young lawyers and law students is never be shy to ask for help. I can't really remember a time where I asked a colleague for help and they said no. In many cases, I think they were flattered that I asked them and they did help me. There was one guy who was just a great business development lawyer at the firm. He's a guy that grew up in the summers selling encyclopedias, right? So he understood the sales piece of what we do a lot earlier than most. And so he's someone I sought help from. I also did take a course, and a lot of what I learned in the course, it would seem elementary to me now, may seem elementary to others now, but at the time I needed some of those obvious things just to be reinforced and really to systematize business development. And the big shift for me really was that I realized, look, about a third of what I'm doing needs to be focused on building the pipeline, building the business. And so now 2/3 of my time today is practicing, and the other third is really what I would call practice development. And the reality of that is, you kind of do the math, and big firm lawyers, even at the partner level, they'd love you to bill about 2,000 hours or more Then you spend another 1,000 hours of business development. I mean, even if you take a couple of weeks of vacation and you do 6 days a week, I mean, that's 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. So it's hard. But candidly, I think if you just look at the most successful partners at the AmLaw 25 firms, that's what they're doing. And so now, being someone who has a kid in college who's thinking about law school, I'm very transparent with her about, you know, you've seen what it takes and you need to really decide, is that what you want to do? Are you in for it?
As you were building those business development skills, did you look back on your time in student government at University of Tennessee when you were interacting with members of the boards of visitors, people who were in the university administration, and draw on some of those experiences dealing with older people and apply that to the situation you found yourself in as a law firm partner having to generate business?
Absolutely. And look, I think the more that you have those experiences, either as part of the practice or before you were practicing, you learn from them and you apply them going forward. I mean, I had a comfort level dealing with people who were older, had very serious senior executive type positions, because I was fortunate to have those opportunities even as a very young person. And I think about some of the meetings that I had to go into 15 years ago and how nervous I was. And then I think about it now. I do those meetings all the time and I don't get nervous, right? Because it becomes second nature. But I think it's important for people to put themselves in those types of experiences so that they do gain a comfort level. And I think whether it's the actual execution of the work or having a level of confidence, because people can sense that when they're making the hiring decision, at some level you have it or you don't. And it's important to have had those opportunities.
As an associate, to some extent, your partner is your client. So what are the similarities and differences between how you approach as an associate, but how you interact with a partner, and then as a partner, thinking about how you interact with a client or a potential client?
So a couple of things. On a personal level, when I'm managing and working with a team, I always emphasize for them what's the end goal, and that ultimately this is all about making sure that the client gets the excellent work product that they deserve. I do think sometimes when I was an associate, my client absolutely was the partner that I was working for. And in many cases, I worked with a couple of partners where we had daily morning meetings and afternoon meetings on the status, you know, where are all the key work streams? And I still do some of that with people I work with today, but I probably was not as effective, or at least didn't have the appreciation for what I was doing and how did it fit into the bigger picture and what did it mean for the client as an associate. And so I try to do a better job of that with the people that I work with. And it's little things, right? And I say this to the associates that work with me, while I may not remember to say to you, hey, as opposed to dialing in by Zoom or Teams down the hall from me, let's just do this in my office. Because what happens when we're together on a physical level is that after the meeting, we end up just having a discussion about what did that all mean? And that sometimes is as important as what happened during the call, is that context. And so I think the context is something that does get lost for many associates.
Talk about how you think about your role as a manager, both as a partner on deal teams, but also as co-head of the corporate group.
Sure. Well, look, from a deal team perspective, I view my job basically as I need to find the work and I need to manage the work on a daily basis so that I'm keeping me and six or seven other people busy. And so when I really think about what gets me out of bed every morning, it's the need to keep those six or seven other people busy and also invest in them, their career development, and all of that, because that's the key. And I also recognize at some level their families depend on that being the case. And so there's a little pit in my stomach every morning thinking about those people and their extended families. The other thing about that immediate group that gets me going is, look, I'm 25 plus years into this at this point. So I'm well over halfway home, likely, in my career. And so I am at the stage where I think about, you know, legacy. And it's at some level what you leave behind and how successful are the people who grew up working for you. That's just as important as my own success, you know, at this stage. And so I'm also just very invested in their personal and professional development. That's very important to me. From a team level, backing up, some of those same themes are true, but there are bigger strategic considerations. You know, I also just happen to serve on our firm's, you know, we call it our policy committee, but it's essentially like a board of directors. And so there are some key strategic issues that I focus on as a team leader and also as a member of that body. And I would say number one right now is probably culture. There are others, but that's key. And you know, we do a lot of things to reinforce our culture. We make sure, frankly, our compensation system is structured to reinforce our culture. But I think in this era where the war for talent, whether it's new associates, lateral partners, and frankly, keeping your existing talent is so fierce, you have to have bonds that are stronger than just the dollar. And to me, that's about culture and people feeling tethered to their colleagues and the institution. And I think you have to be intentional about that, because if it just becomes about the dollars, someone down the street's always going to be willing to pay more, at least for a period of time.
What else in that role as a member of the policy committee are you particularly focused on now?
A couple of things. One, it's increasingly difficult to have practices that meet the profitability standards of the top 20, 25 law firms in the country. And what I mean by that is you have to have a certain scale of practice. The practice can't be commoditized. And so we're constantly evaluating, do we have the right practice mix? What investments do we need to make to ensure that that's the case? And increasingly, are those practices differentiated? Because why hire firm X versus the 50 other firms that are competing for the same business? There has to be an edge or a wedge in many cases, or you know, some type of brand. And so I think when I started at the firm, there were a number of practices that just don't exist at the firm today because they've become commoditized. And you know, there are 100 other firms that can do it a lot cheaper. And so we have to be very intentional about the work that we take on for our clients and what we invest in, and then the things that we de-emphasize over time.
And that puts a lot of pressure on the individual lawyer to manage their career.
Absolutely. I served for 4 years on our firm's compensation committee. And one of the things I thought was fascinating about that process was the feedback loop. We spent a lot of time after every compensation cycle, we would prepare memos for everyone that went through the process. We would have individual meetings with the practice group leader or someone from the committee and go through the feedback in detail. And one of the things that I started to see happen during that, and I talked to our chairman about it, was this concept that a lot of our lawyers needed to have majors and minors, with the idea that there are going to be macro shifts in what we do over a 5-year period of time. And you have to have the ability to pivot as the world changes, right? I mean, look, if I was still doing, I don't know, 50% disclosing on SEC advisory work, for example, today versus the mix in M&A, I mean, the math just wouldn't work on our platform. I mean, I couldn't do it. And so those are the types of things that I think are interesting. But you're absolutely right. Every lawyer has to manage their own business. All of us as partners are owners, and the feedback is really meant to position those owners to best manage their own P&L and have great long-term success as partners at the law firm.
And my sense is that associates at these firms who see themselves possibly becoming partners understand that maybe even by the time they're mid-level associates.
I think so. And again, I don't have as much insight into other firms, but I can tell you at King & Spalding, we do a much better job of making sure that our lawyers at the associate level are good at everything. And at some level, being excellent at whatever their focus area is, that's table stakes. But we're getting much better at also training them on the business of being a lawyer, understanding, again, that business development apparatus, how important that is, and getting them involved at a very young age. I mean, many of these lawyers today are investing in individual relationships with people at companies, at private equity firms that are going to pay huge dividends over time, because the people that they are becoming very close to are ultimately going to ascend to these senior positions. And we're strategic about giving them budgets and encouraging them to do that. And they're learning how to do it, right, in a way that I think generation before them probably didn't at the same level.
And then finally, how do you decompress from what's clearly a really demanding job?
So I've always been, I say always, at least since I met my wife, been a bit of a physical fitness buff. And in particular, any type of biking, mountain biking, road biking, gravel biking, I do it all. But mountain biking in particular, I love to do, because, you know, when you're careening down a trail with a tree coming at you at 20 miles an hour, by definition, you can't be thinking about work or anything else. And so for me, that's a time on the weekends to just let it go and recharge the batteries. I try to do it even when I'm on work trips. I'll rent a bike and go out early in the morning or in the evening if I don't have a dinner and try to get a ride in.
Keith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, David.
For Drinks with the Deal, I'm David Marcus.